أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأسر والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم إلى الآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This evening, I want to continue and try to conclude the commentary of Surah Al-Qalam, chapter number 68 of the Quran. As you'll recall, this is the chapter that we began last year in the month of Ramadan. And tonight we'll come to the culmination and the conclusion by looking at the last two verses of this chapter of the Quran. And the theme that I want to look at under this verse, or under these two verses rather, are the spiritual attacks. And to see how Allah brings forth this topic and what is the religious response to it. Let me first go to the verses that I want to look at tonight, verse number 51 and number 52. And this is probably one of the most famous verses that you will see people tend to recite, that people will hang in their homes. If you go to Muslim countries in the Middle East, you will see that people will buy plaques with this verse of the Quran on it. And I'm sure many people here have this verse somewhere at their home on a wall from a plaque that they have purchased overseas. The verse says this, Allah says, وَإِنْ يَكَادُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا لَيُزْلِكُونَكَ بِأَبْصَارِهِمْ لَمَّا سَمِعُوا ذِكْرَ وَيَكُولُونَ إِنَّهُ لَمَجْنُونَ وَمَا هُوَ إِلَّا ذِكْرٌ لِلْعَالَمِينَ The translation really doesn't do justice to what Allah is wanting to convey. But the simple translation says that when those who disbelieve, now keeping in mind that this verse was revealed at the time of Rasulullah, Allah is speaking to the Prophet, and so Allah is telling Rasulullah that when those people around you who disbelieve, they would almost attack you with their eyes. Not physically attack you with a knife or a sword, but with their eyes, they would try to attack the Prophet when they hear the reminder, meaning the Quran. And they say about him, about Rasulullah, that innahu lamajnoon, that he's gone insane, he's mad. And Allah concludes it by saying that this Quran is nothing but a reminder to the entire universe, to all people for all time. Now, what I want to look at tonight, and obviously we won't be able to do complete justice to this topic because it is so vast, is the concept of the evil eye. What we call in our tradition, najar, right? We say that somebody did this najar on me. They did an evil eye on me. They looked at me in a bad way, and now things are beginning to spiral out of control in my life. I'm sure we've all heard of this before. We've maybe experienced it in some way. We've maybe met people who have had this experience. They say, well, somebody looked at me in a bad way, and now my marriage is crumbling, my children are going astray, I've lost my job, I've got bad health issues, and so on and so forth. Just by somebody looking at another person. One of the first questions that should pop up into our mind, if we're looking at the Quran objectively and trying to learn from the ayat of Allah, that is this a reality? Right? Today I know that somebody can come and hit me and cause me damage. Somebody can physically get into an altercation with one of us, physically punch us or do something, and we can be caused pain by that. But here the verse is not telling Rasulullah that people were coming and attacking him. They're saying they're using their eyes, looking at the Prophet, and they wanted to cause harm and grief and stress to Rasulullah by the way that they looked at somebody. Now, one of the first things I want to mention is that this concept of an evil eye, this concept of najr, if we use that word, is something which is rooted in even pre-Islamic traditions. The earliest philosophers from the Romans and the Greeks, they had this concept of an evil eye. Later on, it came into religion. Judaism, for example, has this belief of the evil eye. Christianity, from what I was able to get, understand from looking at their teachings, doesn't seem to accept this notion. But definitely a lot of people in many parts of the world, mostly from the Eastern world, from, for example, the Middle East, from the Far East, and as of recent in South America, in certain countries in South America, they believe in this concept of the evil eye. And so sometimes even you'll go to somebody's house, Muslim or not, and you'll see, for example, they'll have a plaque on the wall which looks like an eye, with a white circle and then a blue, and concentric circles of different blue, different shades of blue. Or something what they call the hand of Fatima, or the hand of Maryam. It's like a panja, like the hand, like an alam, and it has an eye in the middle. And maybe you have these at home or in keychains, you've seen these around, I'm sure. Again, if you go to Ziyarat, to Iran, to Iraq, you'll see these being sold in the bazaars. In Turkey, they're available, in Egypt, many other countries. But to come back to it, that does this actually have a reality? Can it be possible that with the eye, that you could emit some kind of energy, some electromagnetic energy, to change the destiny of somebody? I mean, ultimately, as Muslims, we don't believe in superstitions. You know, the society that we live in, they have these superstitions. Number 13 is unlucky. So you go in a building, many buildings, they'll go from the 12th floor to the 14th floor. Even till today, you'll see this. It's a superstition. Don't walk under a ladder. If a black cat crosses your path, it's bad luck. You break a mirror, 7 years bad luck. First of all, obviously, as Muslims, we don't accept any of these superstitions. They're from sometimes some groups, some individuals had bad luck when something like this happened, and it has carried on till today. So as Muslims, we don't believe in bad luck. We believe that everything is in control by Allah. Obviously, the world is in control by Allah, but He lets it run in its own specific course. So is it really possible for the eye to actually affect change within an individual? Well, one of the summaries that we have in the hadith is that, and we see this again in many different cultures and religions, is what this definition is. They say that this evil eye is a curse which is believed to be cast by a malevolent glance, usually given to somebody or by somebody to another one when they're unaware of it. And again, many cultures believe in this. So it seems to be a reality. But what does Islam say about it? I want to just give us two hadith and then look at a few different examples and understandings of this. If you go to Nahjul Balagha, the book of sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam, and as you know, Nahjul Balagha is in three portions. Portion number one, as Sayyid Radi compiled, are the sermons, the khutbas of Amir al-Mu'mineen. Portion number two are the letters that Amir al-Mu'mineen himself wrote to his governors, to his friends, to his opponents. And number three, the third part of Nahjul Balagha, are the short sayings. Short one word, one line, two line sentences Amir al-Mu'mineen has been quoted as saying. And so in that third portion, in saying number 400, and it might differ by one or two if you look at different versions, but it's usually around number 400. It's a long hadith. It's about two or three sentences. But the beginning, Imam Ali says that the ayn, the eye, meaning evil eye, he says is a reality. There is a haqiqah to this evil eye. But he says that the prayer and supplication to remove it is also a reality. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, he talks about other things, about magic and witchcraft, also in the same saying as being a reality. Because even the Quran speaks about magic. You look at Surah Al-Baqarah, there's a story about the time of Nabi Sulaiman, Prophet Solomon, and how angels came down, or two individuals were sent to teach magic, to counter other magic. And then people learned it, and they used it, as the Quran says, to cause friction between a husband and a wife so that divorce would happen. There's an entire story about that you can read in Surah Al-Baqarah. So magic is a reality in Islam. This sort of sorcery is a reality. And as Amir al-Mu'mineen says, even this evil eye is a reality. So to answer one of the questions that we've maybe as a culture traditionally we've thought that this whole thing of evil eye and Najr, yes, it is a reality in Islam. It is a reality, and there are also religious antidotes to prevent it, to remove it. As a side note, I should say that sometimes though our community members, sometimes we get a bit carried away with it. Something happens bad in our life and immediately we think somebody's done some kind of witchcraft on us. That they've gone back home to some Middle Eastern or African country and paid somebody to do some voodoo on us. And now my whole life is going into shambles. So we have to be careful that we don't over-conflate the issue. That we don't make a, as they say, don't make a mountain out of a molehill. Yes, magic is real. Sorcery has a reality. Evil eye has a potency to it. But every time something bad happens in our lives, we should not immediately assume that it is based upon that. We have to look at our own lives. Maybe we are responsible. We get an accident. Do we blame that or we blame ourselves that we weren't, you know, looking where we were driving? We were on our cell phone being distracted. And that's why we had the accident. Many things are coming into play. We don't always jump to the fact that it may be some supernatural, you know, phenomenon. No, sometimes we ourselves as believers need to take credit. Maybe we're committing sins. For example, in Dua Kamil, which we just heard being recited, we talk about all of these sins. Allahumma ghafir li adhanub allati taqta'u ar-raja tunzilu al-bala. Some sins that send down calamities upon us. Sometimes we commit sins, and because of that, something bad happens to us. So there is a correlation between sinning and bala, or tribulations. Don't blame the voodoo and magic from East Africa that somebody in Dar es Salaam or Mombasa did something weird to me. No, look at my life. Did I commit a sin? Am I perpetuating sins in my life? And Allah is now showing me the outcome of those sins. So that's the first thing, and this is the hadith that we have from Amir al-Mu'mineen. In the second tradition, we have the following, where actually it was an event where Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam are young children, probably a few years old, because obviously they died when they were alive when Rasulullah was there, and they obviously saw Rasulullah, and when they were only about maybe 6, 7 is when Rasulullah passed away. So one day Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam come to Rasulullah with Imam Ali alayhi salam. And what happens is that there was some issues with the children, they weren't feeling well, something was happening. And so Rasulullah gives them what we call an amulet, a talisman. What we call in our language, for example, a ta'viz. Right? You know, we got these people that write ta'viz and du'as. Some of them are real, some of them unfortunately just take money from people. But this was a reality that using this ta'viz, these du'as, and keeping it with you was a reality even by the time of Rasulullah. Right? It's not just a homemade tradition. You know, even ayat of the Quran, it's mustahab, for example. As a side note, to write ayatul kursi and keep it in your house, on your walls. There's barakah, there's blessings, there is protection from ayat of the Quran. And so this was actually a dua that Rasulullah made. He had it written. Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhi wasalam would carry it with them. But Rasulullah actually read this dua for them. And look at what the dua says, where Rasulullah says, I seek refuge for the two of you, meaning Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhi wasalam, in the complete words and the most beautiful names of Allah, all of them, from the evil of death and wild animals and from every wicked eye. Again, that concept of that evil eye is there. وَمِن شَرِّ كُلِّ عَيْنٍ لَامَ. And from every envious person when he shows envy. Right? وَمِن شَرِّ حَاسِدٍ إِذَا حَسَد. Just like the surah of the Quran, where we seek refuge in Allah from hasad, from people who show jealousy. If envy wasn't dangerous, if it wasn't, you know, something which could cause an effect to us, that is a supernatural, a metaphysical reality, that even that surah, the surah Falak and Nas, would almost make no sense. Because why would we seek refuge in Allah from the hasid, the one who shows envy, when he envies? If jealousy had no problem, right, the green-eyed monster, as our kids might know him as, the monster that caused the envy in our lives, if being envious of somebody had no impact, why would that verse say, وَإِذَا حَاسِدٍ إِذَا حَسَدٍ? So that shows us that there is a metaphysical reality above this world. Science might not have been able to quantify it, to measure it, to actually determine, is the eye, evil eye, a reality? But even though science might not have come to that conclusion, Allah says in the Quran, وَإِنْ يَكَادُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا, that when those who disbelieve might kill you with their eyes, there needs to be an analysis done. Maybe my Muslim scientist to see what is this reality. When Allah says, وَإِذَا حَاسِدٍ إِذَا حَسَدٍ, when I seek refuge in Allah from the jealous one or the envious one when they envy, there has to be some relation in my life with envy and what can happen to me, or what can happen to me if I show it, or what can happen if somebody becomes envious of me. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And so just to conclude this portion before I go into one last part, is that from these two very brief du'as, two hadith rather, the one hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen and the du'a from Rasulullah, it shows us that this influence of evil is not just an illusion. It's not just something that Muslims, think about, and it's not a reality. There is a reality to it. We might not understand it today. We might not, again, scientists might not have been able to quantify, to measure this evil eye. Does it work? How does it function? But because there are ayat of the Quran, we have to accept that it is a reality. Because we have hadith that talk about it, we have to accept it as a reality. Because we have du'as, we have many different du'as that talk to us about how to prevent it, about how to remove it if it's there. We have to realize it as a reality. It's not just a superstition from 14 centuries ago. Right? A lot of things exist within Islam that we don't know today why they're there. We can't understand a lot of our religion. You know, just very simple examples. I've probably mentioned them before, but it doesn't hurt to mention them again. People ask, why did Allah choose 2 rakat for Salatul Fajr? What is the reason, the rationale? Is there any scientific benefit to praying 2 rakat at a certain time of the day? Maybe not. Maybe there's absolutely no scientific reason behind that. But because of the fact that Allah said it, and we mentioned this a few months ago, that there's hadith that said that everything which is legislated in the Sharia, which is halal, which is recommended, or which is an obligation, is there because there's a benefit for us. And whatever is prohibited, whatever is haram, is because there is a harm for us. Maybe we can't quantify it. Why prayers are 2 rakat for dhuhr or for fajr, 4 rakat for dhuhr. We can't quantify that. We can't measure it. But if Allah stated it, there must be some benefit of it. And if no benefit, ultimately the benefit is that we followed Allah. There are a lot of things, and actually really in probably our entire Sharia, our entire legal code, although we have books like Sheikh Saduq has written Ilul al-Shira'i, a beautiful book where he explains or he tries to bring out a hadith of why certain things are within the religion. Why is rabbit meat haram, for example? He has hadith of why the rabbit is haram. And it's a very graphic hadith, so I don't want to mention it tonight. But there are a lot of details of why certain things are allowed, why they're not allowed. So maybe something like this, maybe it has a real scientific reality that up until now science has not been able to produce a response for. But maybe they just haven't bothered to study about it because it doesn't, benefit maybe many people. I want to conclude with a portion of a research report I recently read, and this is available, you can Google it online, written by an American researcher, Colin Ross, where he does this research paper, and it's about 30 or 40 pages. And his hypothesis is, as he calls it, the electrophysiological basis of evil eye belief. So he wants to try to analyze this issue of the evil eye. Different cultures, the Greek cultures, South Americans, people in the Middle East, the Jewish community, many communities believe in it. His question was, is this a reality? Or is it just folklore? Is it just mythology that has transcended into religion? I'm just going to give you three paragraphs or three sentences of what he states in his research. He says that the sense of being stared at is the basis of evil eye beliefs, which are regarded as superstitions because the emission of any form of energy from the human eye has been rejected by Western science. So yes, we can take in light with our eyes and this is how we see things, but he's saying that the opposite has been rejected, that can the eye emit light or energy outside, you know, can it project energy outside of itself? He says, however, brain waves in the 1 to 40 hertz, 1 to 10 microvolt range emitted through the eye can be detected using a high impedance electrode housed inside electromagnetically insulated goggles. And again, it's a long thesis. Go and read it and try to understand what he's saying, but you'll see also what his conclusion he mentions here tonight. He then goes on to say that this signal, which this author calls human ocular extramission, is physiologically active and has distinct electrophysiological properties from simultaneous brainwave recordings over the forehead. So he's done limited research and he's found some examples and testing in the laboratory, and he's proved that there are energies that can come out of the human being. Again, and his research is online. You can go and refer to it. And then in the last portion, he says the following. He says that Western science's rejection of evil eye beliefs may be based on an erroneous rejection of a widespread component of human consciousness, the sense of being stared at, which may in turn be based on a real electrophysiological signal. The author proposes a series of future studies designed to determine whether human ocular extramission is the basis of evil eye beliefs. So in a nutshell, he is saying that don't discount this theory, that what religions have talked about the evil eye, because he has been able to detect a very small, minute trace of this energy coming forth, that maybe there is a reality to it. And this is why we've said in the past that, you know, many times as Muslims, especially the younger generation, we tend to discount things. We hear something about religion, it doesn't make sense. We discount it. We say, I don't understand it. I won't accept it until it makes logical sense to me. I won't accept it until science comes and says that this is a benefit for humanity. Sometimes we have this notion, and it's, in a way, it's okay to think like that because it makes us more inquisitive and thinking and want to learn about our religion and wanting to delve deeper into it. So that's not a problem. But we have to be careful that we don't try and quantify or make sure that science can approve every single aspect of our religion. Because if we go down that route, it becomes a slippery route because we will begin to end up denying much of our religion. Right? We'll say, well, the beard, their maraja say it's haram to shave, but science has not proven any harm with shaving. Wearing gold, for example, why does Islam say it's haram for men to wear gold? Gold rings, gold necklaces, gold watches. Sometimes men have gold in their glasses. Some scholars say that's haram to even have gold in your glasses, in the frames of your eyeglasses. But if you look at science, maybe they'll say there's no harm with men wearing gold. There's no chemical reaction, no health problems that are caused by the touching of the gold on the skin of the man. Maybe science will say that. But does that now mean that because science says it's okay that Islam, there's something wrong with the religion? No, there has to be something why Islam put it there. And again, even if we say there's no scientific evidence to ban gold for men, or ban silk for men, because silk, pure silk, is also haram. Then we put it into the category of things that Allah has told us not to do. We don't know why, but maybe there is a benefit in the world to come for us. I'll conclude with just a few points to reflect on this passage, on these last two verses. Things that we can learn from this two verses that we have gone over tonight. Point number one is that the plans and the plots of the enemies are real. Right? And we need to be aware of them. And the Quran tells us this about our enemies many times. And this verse Allah told the Prophet, وَإِنْ يَكَادُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا لِيَزْلِقُونَكَ بِأَبْصَارِهِمْ, that the disbelievers would like to destroy you with their eyes. So we have to realize that we live in very, you know, volatile times. We live in a time when Islam is under attack. You see this happening, what's happening right now even in Iran, and the mass media twisting the event. I mean, if you're following even this, the protests in Iran, and just as a side note, Twitter, people like major news stations were reposting images on Twitter, on social media, of rallies that happened in Bahrain 2 years ago with the caption that these are the protests in Iran against the government. Blatant lies. Like, people are all with Bahrain flags in Bahrain, and the news media, major outlets, are putting pictures of from Bahrain 2 years ago with a heading, protests in Iran against the government. So we have to be aware that we live in times where these media outlets, certain governments, are not in the favor of Islam and Muslims, and they have plans and plots against us. This concept that our scholars talk about the enemy being real, it's not just a boogeyman. These are real enemies that are against Islam, that want to see Islam fail. And so we have to be aware of them. Rasulullah was made aware of them. Allah gave him different adhkar, different dhikrs to recite, different ways to spiritually fortify himself and the community. We also have to be aware of these realities in our lives. Point number two is that the brutal attacks of the enemies are primarily aimed at the religious leaders of the community. Right? They could not always attack the companions of Rasulullah. You can kill one or two companions like they did to the parents of Ammar ibn Yasir, like they did to other companions, but that would not stop the movement. Right? You kill one companion, another one is there. But you attack the leader of the movement, and that is where you see then that is where the problems begin. And again, we see that even in our own contemporary times. If you look at what's happened after the revolution of 1979 in Iran, very recently, within the last maybe 5 to 10 years, many governments around the world, when they want to demonize and vilify the movement in Iran, what do they say? They don't call the people lunatics or crazy people. They say those mullahs in Tehran. And that's the actual term, those mullahs in Tehran. And when you hear that term, we have to realize that they are attacking marja'iyat, whether it be Ayatollah Khamenei, whether it be Ayatollah Sistani. For them, it doesn't matter. One is not a moderate, and one is not an extremist or a liberal. They have an agenda. They can't get to the people, but they attack the leadership by calling them fanatical, by calling them all these names. Just the other day, I was watching CBC News, and three so-called experts of Iran were on CBC News panel talking about what's happening in Iran. And all three were anti-Iran. They had their own agendas. They had people representing different groups within the country. And one man said that for the last 40 years, the entire population has been against the clerical establishment in Iran. Now, if you've studied the revolution, you would know that when they had a referendum after the revolution happened to decide whether they wanted to be ruled by Islamic law, 97% of the people voted for Islamic government. So to say on national television that since the time of the revolution, 100% of the Iranians have been against Islamic government is obviously a fallacy, and it's completely against historical basis and historical facts. But what they do is they'll put these things into our heads. They'll say this mullah, this ayatollah is like this, and that's unfortunate, that derogatory term they use, mullah. Because mullah is a good word, but they use it in a negative way. But they say that ayatollah is bad, that ayatollah is good, this ayatollah works with America, this one is against America. And so they try to weaken our leadership of the Shia so that we just become like sheep without a leader, without a guide to take us to the 12th Imam. Point number three is that even though we might not fully understand this discussion, this evil eye is a reality. Again, I stress on the point that let us not get over carried away with it. Let's not assume that just because something happened, immediately we go to this. Let's look at our own personal life. Am I doing something wrong? Am I sinning? Am I breaking Allah's laws? You know, if you get a speeding ticket, don't blame evil eye. that somebody saw me in my, you know, in my Lamborghini, and so I got a speeding ticket. No, you were speeding because you had a Lamborghini. So blame yourself for pushing that gas a bit too hard. Right? Everything in life, don't always look for a scapegoat. Let's look to ourselves sometimes. Again, I'm not saying it's not a reality, but we can't get carried away. And the last few points, I'll conclude with this for tonight, is that we always need to stand up and defend our religious leadership, both the leadership in general and our religious leadership. And as you see, Allah does this. When the kuffar said, وَيَكُولُونَ إِنَّهُ لَمَجْنُونَ, that he's insane, he's a crazy man, what did Allah say? Allah came back and said, مَا أَنْتَ بِنِعْمَةِ رَبِّكَ بِمَجْنُونَ, by the grace of your Lord, you're not insane. Right? These people who are calling you crazy, they have some problems in their head. Allah, you know, vilified and vindicated the Prophet. He said, don't listen to these people. They're calling you an insane man. You are on the straight path. We read that tonight. إِنَّكَ لَمِنَ الْمُرْسَلِينَ عَلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ. You, the Prophet, are on that straight path. You're not crazy. They're calling you a magician. What? Because you're bringing about respect, tolerance, love, appreciation in a community. They call you a magician. No, he's not a magician. He's bringing about a society, a civil society. He's not crazy. He's not a poet. Right? As we even read in the Quran, that this Quran is not poetry, nor is Rasulullah a poet. وَمَا يَنْبَغِي لَهُ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا ذِكْرٌ وَقُرْآنٌ مُبِينٌ. This is a reminder and a manifest recitation, a clear recitation. So we have to defend our leadership. When we hear governments, many of these Western governments critiquing our marja'iyat, saying they're like this and like that, and they're like this and they're backwards, and how do they know who we are? We have to defend them. It might not make a difference, but at least we have done our part in protecting this institution and ensuring that it is respected within our communities. The sixth point is that recitation of the Quran is a way to prevent the spiritual negligence, what they call ghafla. And that's why Allah also refers it to as dhikr, as a reminder, as a remembrance. And the more we become attached to the Quran, the more we read the Quran, the more we recite and reflect and think on the Quran, the more that it will prevent us from that state of negligence, of being distanced from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And last but not least is that the Quran is not a book limited to time or a specific region. As Allah says that it is a dhikrun lil alameen. Right? Rasulullah is rahmatun lil alameen. Allah is rabbul alameen. And the Quran is dhikrun lil alameen. The Quran is for all time. Right? Just because today you and I don't understand the concepts of Quran, evil eye, or this or that, or why is hijab mandatory? It doesn't make sense to me. Women say 21st century hijab isn't mandatory. It doesn't make sense. It was for that time, for that region. Just because you and I don't understand it, we shouldn't discount it so quickly. There are a lot of things we and I don't understand, but yet we accept. We don't know how cell phones work. We don't know how these waves travel, and that we can surf the internet while the Mawlana is giving a majlis. Not that anybody here is doing that, I'll just give you an example. But we believe that a cell phone works, although we don't see the waves leaving our phone, but we accept it as a reality. So let's accept the Quranic reality, even though it's not clear to us, it's not apparent to us. It doesn't, you know, we can't measure the Quran in terms of its scientific acceptability in today's day and age. And if we do this, then inshallah, when we read the Quran, we will be able to benefit it. We will be able to benefit from it, rather. And we can ask Allah for the ability to be able to actually read and benefit from the Quran, and to ask Allah for the ability to actually spend some time and devote our lives to reading and understanding the Quran. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. And as we conclude for tonight, let me just mention one last word. As we also commemorate the Isala Thawab Majlis for one of our community members whose brother passed away just a few days ago. And you know, anytime any of us lose a family member, it's always a difficult thing. It's never easy for anybody to lose a member, whether they are living close to them or whether they're hundreds of kilometers or thousands of kilometers away. Death is never an easy thing, but we always realize As we read in the Quran that inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un, we all are coming from Allah. Allah was our starting point. And as we say that wa inna ilayhi raji'un, that we all are going to return back to Allah. This is a journey that each and every one of us will have to take one time in our lives, that we will all leave this world to go back to Allah. But obviously when we lose a family member, it hurts much. And especially when we're not there to be beside them, to be with the family, to share in that grief, it becomes even more difficult. But one of the beauties of the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam is that they have taught us that no matter how much grief that we have, no matter how much we shed tears when we lose a loved one, we can always reflect back on Karbala. We can all reflect back on that tragedy of Ashura, and we see that everybody lost somebody in their life. Some lost their husbands, some lost their children, some lost their cousins, some lost their brothers. And when we commemorate these Isal al-Thawab majlises, we remember the tragedy of Karbala and the Shuhada of Karbala alayhum as-salam. And especially when we look at what Lady Zainab alayhi as-salam had to lose. It wasn't just Zainab alayhi as-salam who lost one or two people. We know that Bibi Zainab alayhi as-salam on the day of Ashura, she had to see so many tragedies, one after the other after the other. Her sons, Onan and Muhammad, go to the battlefield, and we know that those two young boys, they never come back after they bid farewell to their mother, Bibi Zainab. We know that finally on the day of Ashura, in those hours after many of the young men had been killed, that Abu al-Fadl Abbas, alayhi salam, he begins to be agitated. He's really wanting to go to the battlefield. He goes to his Mawla and his master, his brother Hussein. He says, give me the permission, Ya Abu Abdullah, O my master, to go to the battlefield. Let me end these hypocrites' lives. Imam Hussein realizes that, he tells Abu al-Fadl Abbas, he says that you are the standard bearer of my alam. You're the one who holds my flag. If you were to leave, if you were to be killed, who will be there to hold the flag? Who will be there to give the family that consolation? Eventually, finally, Imam Hussein tells Abu al-Fadl Abbas that if you really have to go, if you really feel the need to go, then hear those children crying, Al-Atash, Al-Atash. They're crying that they're thirsty. He tells him, go to the water, go to the Furat, go to the Euphrates and get some water for those children. Abu al-Fadl Abbas pays farewell to the children. He says goodbye to Bibi Zainab. He makes his way towards the water. As we know, that tragic day of Ashura, when Abu al-Fadl gives his life, he makes it to the water. He jumps down off of his horse. He puts his hands into the water. He takes a scoop full of water in his hands. And then he remembers what the family is going through in the tents. And he recites those words of poetry where he says that, oh Abbas, he says, how can you drink water? How can you drink this cold, refreshing water while your family are suffering of the thirst of the desert of Karbala? He says that this is not the way of my religion. Abu al-Fadl Abbas throws the water back into the river. He takes the mushk, he takes the flask and begins to fill it up. As we know that he makes his way back to the camp. As he's approaching back to the camp, an enemy comes from one side. They begin to attack Abu al-Fadl Abbas. One of his arms is cut off of his body. He takes the water, he puts it in his other hand. As he goes a bit forward, another enemy comes and cuts off the other arm of Abu al-Fadl Abbas. He now has no arms. He has no arms, but he has the water he's still holding. He still has the alam, the flag of Hussein that he's holding with him. Eventually, he begins to be attacked from all of the different directions. He attacked, and he sees the enemies coming him from all different sides, throwing stones on him, hitting him with their spears, whatever they have. Eventually, Abu Fadl Abbas sees that an arrow pierces the water bag. The water begins to come out of the bag. The water begins to go over the dirt of Karbala. At this point, Abu al-Fadl Abbas realized that he hasn't been successful. He hasn't been able to bring the water to the women, to the children who had asked him just for a few drops of water to satiate their thirst on the day of Ashura. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. We ask Allah through the Quran and through Abu al-Fadl Abbas and through the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam to accept this act of worship from us tonight. We ask Allah to give the thawab of this majlis to all of the marhumin, especially those who have sponsored the majlis for tonight, for their marhumin. We ask Allah to put the marhumin of all of those who have left this world from our community, our family, our friends, from the ulama, the shuhada, that Allah gives them all proximity to Muhammad and Ali Muhammad alayhum as-salam. We ask Allah to keep us all on the path of Islam and the path of the Ahlul Bayt, and that Allah hasten the return of our Twelfth Imam, Imam Al-Mahdi, and that we can live to see the dawn of the time of the advent of Imam Al-Hujjah. ربنا تقبل منا إنك أنت السميع العليم صلوا على محمد وآل محمد.
أزور سيدي ومولاي أصالة عن نفسي ونيابة عن والدي ووالد والدي وكل من أوصاني الدعاء والزيارة. السلام عليك يا وارث آدم.